From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A federal disaster has been declared in parts of south central Louisiana after that storm system that dumped 20 inches of rain and caused massive flooding before moving west. It's now crawling into Texas. FEMA, the emergency agency, is in Louisiana today, but residents have been launching an emergency response since the weekend. Civilian volunteers, including a Facebook community of hunters and fishermen, throwing their boats on the back of four-wheel drive trucks and rescuing people from completely different towns. It's an extension of a movement founded during Hurricane Katrina known as the Cajun Navy. Jared Serenay of St. Bernard Parish was home watching storm footage with his newborn when he remembered a friend who joined up with the Cajun Navy during Katrina. And Jared was inspired to go this time, leaving his baby and wife. He's back with him now. Jared, where did you go?
On Saturday, we went to Baton Rouge and we worked at a neighborhood called Monticello. When we first got there, we were going to houses that probably had, 3 foot of water approaching 4 foot, mm-hmm. and started pulling people who, some of them had water in their house already, some of them didn't. You know, their house, maybe their house was 3 to 4 foot off the ground.
We understand you found people in shock on their porches at the fact that they were stranded. People living in a tent on top of a five and dime store or something like that?
Right. That was on Sunday. But on Saturday, we knew it was real because as soon as we were putting our boats in, we heard one of the, there weren't very many first responders there, but one of the deputies there, we heard him yell to another deputy that they had already just found a dead body floating in the water. So we knew it was real. So we started pulling people on Saturday, and a lot of them, like I said, were just kind of in shock or just not really, the water had come up so quick that they really, it caught them all off guard.
Yeah.
And then Sunday, we kind of really tried to go to an area called Denham Springs where we kept getting reports where it was really bad, but there was no way to really drive into Denham. So we kind of just followed the GPS maps and tried to get to the water. We could never get to Denham, but we crossed the Amite River and got into a place called Port Vincent, and that's where There was no, essentially no authorities there. And we found some, two stores. One of them was the Dollar General store, and there were people camped out on the roof.
And so you bring these people out, I'm imagining all ages. What did they seem like? Is this something that people think, oh, here the water's rising again? Or were they in shock?
Caught completely off guard. Most of these areas have never flooded, so much so that most of the people didn't even have flood insurance. A lot of elderly wanted to leave. A lot of people wanted to stay, and they were just going to ride it out. But a lot of elderly wanted to get out. Of course, like all the small children, we needed to get them out. And then a lot of people bound to wheelchairs. They just, it's much, much better for them if we get them out,
Yeah. Well, how are you feeling today? Probably some of the adrenaline is wearing off. How are you feeling about this?
We learned a lot, yesterday they had some crews go out, and what happened was as it grew and as you posted things on Facebook, you had more and more hunters and fishermen who were like, man, I want to do this. I want to join. And what actually happened, the groups of boats going out grew to these, sizes of like 30 boats and 30 trucks. And yesterday they actually got turned away a lot. Mm-hmm. And we're still kind of figuring out why that was. I mean, some of it was that some of the rescues weren't, the amount of people who needed to be rescued weren't as great as in numbers they were the first 2 days. And some of that was just that, the bureaucracy started to set in. But today we're just kind of staying put. We're on standby, waiting to hear where the water comes up and where we might be needed. But I'll tell you this, if we hadn't mobilized as quickly as we had on those first 2 days, more people would have either been stranded or really in a dangerous position because in most cases we were there before any type of authority was, at least in the areas I worked.
Yeah.
You got guys pulling up thinking, we kept getting reports from Facebook. Oh, this family is trapped on top of this roof or this baby is having a seizure. And these guys take that to heart. And they're like, well, we got a boat. We know how to be on the water. We're going to get them right now. And you pull up and there's a roadblock and there's some local, local police officers. And they say, look, guys, we can't let y'all through. You're not going out today. And, and I understand some of those interactions didn't go the way that the Cajun Navy boys planned, and they felt like they were being turned away from nothing. And we're going to get more details on that, and we don't want to be extremely critical of the local police departments, and we understand everybody's under a lot of pressure, but it was, everybody's emotional right now. And the emotion that my boys felt was that we got boats, we can help, let us in.
I hear you. And yet I'm sure you can understand officials are probably thinking, oh, my gosh, we don't know who is going in there on a boat. What if we have to rescue them? But as it turns out.
Yeah, there's a lot of details we're going to try to sort out. And, you know, you got to figure hurricane season just began, you know, June 1st. So we may be needed again sometime in the near future. And we're just hoping we learn a lot from this on how to help out moving forward.
Yeah. Well, I hear you're home with your baby, your newborn, and glad to hear
his mom has been really awesome letting me go do this. And you know, unfortunately, that means she lost a lot of sleep. So I'm trying to wash in so she can get rested up a little bit.
Jared Serrané, thank you so much.
All right. Have a good one.
Well, the Trump campaign is shooting down a report today in the New York Times that the ousted head of Fox News, Roger Ailes, will be advising Donald Trump ahead of the debates this fall. This is Ailes is still in the midst of sexual harassment allegations from people who worked at Fox News during his time there. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with this latest report from the New York Times that the Trump campaign is saying is not true. What do you know about it?
Well, it feels to me like the kind of grand unification theory of outlandish summer news, right? You have Donald Trump, a candidate almost like no other in recent memory, who says things that set this press scrambling. And you have Roger Ailes, who's you know, seemingly atop the news heap, the driving creative force behind Fox News, the top-rated cable news channel, who has been brought down amidst a cascade of sort of intense allegations of misconduct on his behalf toward women. The idea that Donald Trump on its face, who is really, it seems, been damaged among many women voters, would take on a guy who's seemingly in some ways rivaling Bill Cosby as the bete noire of folks concerned about how women are treated, you know, would seem counterintuitive. But think about who Roger Ailes is. He got his start moving from television in politics in 1968, advising Richard Nixon and really helping him craft a media strategy to lift him back into the White House after he had lost 8 years earlier. And he advised President Ronald Reagan on his run in 1984. For then Vice President George H.W. Bush, and really is in some ways a keener political mind than he is a media mind. That is, he never really took off a political hat. And if you look at the way in which the Times reported this, it wasn't clear that he was being paid. It wasn't clear that they were saying that he would take on a formal role with the campaign. And he's the kind of guy who occasionally sent advice through unofficial channels to, say, the George W. Bush administration at certain key moments. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling this is the kind of conversation Ailes would have been having with Donald Trump even if he had remained atop the Fox News channel.
And, of course, he is not atop the Fox News channel anymore, and that was because of sexual harassment allegations that started coming from Gretchen Carlson, a former anchor from Fox News. But as we've gone on over the last month or so, there have been more allegations coming out. Where are we with that?
Well, you know, not only has Megyn Kelly talked to the law firm that is conducting the review for the parent company 21st Century Fox, a number of women have in the double digits, possibly as high as 20 women, among them Andrea Tanteros. She's a host or has been now on sort of suspended leave as part of The Five, a popular late afternoon show. She says that she complained about sexual harassment by Roger Ailes. The network's defense has been she didn't complain about Roger Ailes' misconduct, but she did complain about the conduct of five other men at Fox News, which is – and they said that the evidence was far from conclusive on whether or not that actually occurred. But it's not exactly the most heartening defense from those who would like Fox News to emerge from this unscathed. I think that you're seeing a lot of revelations about the way in which Fox News operated, and it comes back a little bit to Roger Ailes, of course. He imbued it when he started it 20 years ago and really ramped it up as run on something of a political basis. That is, you reward your friends on the air and off, and you punish your enemies. And from those who are making allegations, they would say that they were they received certain kinds of retribution on and off the air as well.
Well, let's listen here to CNN's Brian Stelter, who made an allegation. Here he is.
About 10 years ago, I had a crush on a woman at Fox News. She was a low-level staffer. I was in college at the time. So I was going out with what I thought were dates, Chris. I thought these were dates. These were not dates. She was actually reporting back to Fox News about me. She was reporting back about what I thought of her and about CNN and MSNBC and Fox. Because I was a reporter on the beat, they were actually spying on me that way.
Just unbelievable, David. And now we have these two new co-presidents of Fox News, Jack Abernathy and Bill Shine. Is the culture likely to change with them at the top?
Well, I think the parent company is spending a lot more attention on running Fox News. Ailes generated so much profit, more than $1 billion a year in recent years, and had such a force of personality that he insisted on autonomy, and that is no interference. Rupert Murdoch, you know, the guy at the top of the pyramid of 21st Century Fox, is now running Fox News. He's elevated Bill Shein, who's been a longtime Ailes' right-hand man and was the head over the opinion side of the network, and also had been a producer for Sean Hannity many, many, many years ago. I don't think it's a cultural change in the sense that people have been elevated, including Shein, including a woman named Suzanne Scott, really were loyalists of Roger Ailes over the years and accused by a few of the women coming forward of being, in a sense, enablers for him. But there is a cultural shift in the sense that 21st Century Fox is no longer tolerating this autonomy that allowed allegedly this incredible misconduct to occur. But if you're looking for who's leading the shop, it seems like it's really status quo. And I think that comes as a surprise for a lot of people who had hoped that this would lead to real cultural change at Fox News. That may have to wait until a Murdoch's sons or someone else steps in and names a new leader after Rupert Murdoch lets go of the reins there.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik with the latest news coming out of Fox News and now the Trump campaign as well. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
The national parks turn 100 years old next week, and I'll be broadcasting from a national park. I'm not going to tell you which one just yet, but it is reliably awesome. Tune in Monday and Tuesday to find out. Meanwhile, all summer, we have been profiling national parks across the country, and today, it's Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Joining us now is Cindy Orlando, superintendent there on the island of Hawaii. Cindy, welcome to Here and Now.
Aloha. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for joining us. And tell us about this park for people who have not been lucky enough to make it all the way there to Hawaii to see it.
Well, Hawaii Volcanoes National Park was established 100 years ago in 1916. And it was established to protect and conserve the volcanic landscapes and, of course, the natural and cultural resources and historic sites. It encompasses two of the world's most active volcanoes, Kilauea and Mauna Loa. And it's the only park in the system that continuously creates new land.
And there's some activity going on right now with these volcanoes at the park, right?
Well, this summer we've had a couple of eruptions. We have two on Kilauea. Kilauea, by the way, has been continuously erupting since 1983.
Huh.
One at the summit at 4,000 feet within Halema'uma'u Crater. At night, there's a dramatic glow that has been seen since 2008. There's a lava lake that's vibrant and visible and has been viewed from the overlook of Jagger Museum. Very accessible. And of course, the other is our newest eruption located 4,000 feet from the summit at our coastal area. On the ride down, one is reminded by numerous geologic features of the power and force of the volcano and is really inspired by dramatic lava fields that represent the birth of new land. And the human story is also evident at Pu'uloa Petroglyph Field, where 23,000 carvings date back between the 13th and 15th centuries.
Hmm.
The flow has been visible on the Pali from the coastal viewing area. All of our lava flows can be accessed by those that are prepared. So we always recommend visitors check in with the rangers on duty before heading out. Walking on hardened lava is not easy.
Well, and I also remember when I visited many years ago that fog was an issue. The volcanic fog made it difficult for people to go into certain areas.
That's right. And we do have to, at times, intermittently close certain sections of the park. You know, we are active volcanoes. The lava represents the birth of Pele. This is her sacred cultural landscape. And Pele is mesmerizing and beautiful, but she's also an active volcano, and there are associated hazards. So you have not only seismic events, you have eruptions, of course, the lava, and volcanic gases, and we can also have explosions.
What is so dangerous for humans about the volcanic gases?
Well, you have this, in this particular case, we have SO2 that affects us directly in the park. But as that SO2 travels out to sea or up the coastline, those particulates break down. And it's actually little tiny fragments of glass. Lava is glass. So folks need to be careful. Anybody with respiratory ailments need to be particularly careful. Young children, the elderly. In fact, one of our significant challenges, of course, is visitor safety. We're a model worldwide for providing access, safe access to lava viewing. And as I say, volcanoes are a natural wonder, and many are drawn to them. But our goal is foremost to keep our employees and visitors safe.
What kind of plant and animal life can people find in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park?
Interestingly enough, we have natural resources. We have an ecosystem that has evolved, adapted, and flourishes on a volcanic landscape. But let's not forget that we also have a Hawaiian culture that linked to Kilauea and Mauna Loa volcanoes, not only historically, but today as well. You know, as I mentioned, this is the home of the volcano goddess Pele. And you can really say three elements describe this park: culture, biology, and geology.
When the lava flows into the water and expands the land, as you've said, does that land become National Park Service land automatically?
You know, it does. There's been many conversations about that. But there's also another interesting thing that happens when the new land is formed. We refer to that in many cases as benches. And oftentimes those benches will subsequently break off into the sea. So though we might have added 1,000 acres 10 years ago, we may only have 500 acres of that left.
Hmm. So what do you tell people to do if they're there for one day? What should they do?
Oh, my goodness gracious. There's so much to do. We have a plethora of activities. It's our centennial year, so this year we have special tourism programs. We have over 150 miles of trails to hike. We have daily ranger-led programs and walks. We have hula programs and performances, music programs, Hawaiian music programs, cultural demonstrations, bird watching. We have restoration and stewardship opportunities. And of course, countless up close and personal volcano learning experiences with Pele.
That's Cindy Orlando, who is the superintendent of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park on the island of Hawaii. Cindy, sounds fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Have a wonderful day. Aloha.
So that's a national park. What about visiting the site of a battle of the Hawaiian Civil War or the French and Indian War? Hundreds of thousands of people every year visit famous battlefields. Earlier this summer, the National Park Service awarded more than $1 million in grants to research and protect lesser-known battlefields, including the 19th century Rogue River Indian War. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network reports.
The Rogue River Indian War started with an uprising of natives against miners and other settlers in southwest Oregon in the mid-1850s. There were massacres, reprisals, pitched battles, and a final forced expulsion of tribes from their homelands to distant reservations. Looking back, two things stand out. Artifacts from the mostly forgotten battles lie just beneath the surface. So, too, human interest in the conflict by descendants and neighbors. A team organized by Southern Oregon University just wrapped up a month-long excavation of two sites near Gold Beach on the Oregon coast.
Ooh! There's the burn.
One site is a former homestead where a family of German immigrants were slain or taken hostage by tribal warriors. A few miles away, archaeologists led by Professor Mark Tveskov uncovered the foundations of a crude earthen fort. Here, native forces laid siege to more than 100 settlers and miners for a month until the U.S. Army arrived.
You can see things that you don't see just from the written word, like the desperation of the people in Miner's Fort is not captured in any pioneer memoir, where they crafted a kind of heroic picture of what happened. And here we could see them cowering in a cabin, being rained on by musket balls, burning their wagons and whaleboats to the last piece of hardware, you know, and that's a material record.
The investigators say they were surprised by how many artifacts they found in this pasture. Project archaeologist Chelsea Rose shows me one of her favorites, a broken chunk of imitation cut crystal.
I love these because they're absolutely impractical. They're heavy, they're bulky, they're breakable, they're everything you wouldn't think you'd want inside this fort.
But Rose says she can relate to the unknown frontier family who, in their moment of desperation, chose to flee with a cherished leaded glass bowl.
We live in an area that's high fire, so I've had to evacuate twice for fire. And what did I bring? Basically the equivalent of this, like photo albums, paintings, you know, nothing practical.
While the archaeologists and summer field school students work, they receive a steady trickle of visitors bearing questions, stories, or artifacts collected long ago. The cultural resources director for the Siletz tribe visited several times. Robert Kenta says for tribal folks, the history of the Indian War is not that old. His grandmother's father lived through it.
That's very fresh in our family stories, you know, how he, by some miracle, was able to survive the wars as an orphan boy, spending that last winter in a kind of hollowed-out sugar pine snag, you know, just scraping, getting by.
Kenta says it's difficult to be reminded of all the suffering people went through on both sides, but he and other tribal visitors came to support the excavation.
It's part of that reconciling of the past with where we're at today and understanding what your family has been through and your whole community has been through. And in some ways, it can help you navigate towards a healthier future.
It's these kinds of reactions that motivate archaeologists Tveskov and Rose.
Everything we do as archaeologists, we're always trying to get back to the people. All these artifacts, you know, they're fun to look at, but really they're a means to an end, and that's to tell us the human story.
Last month, the National Park Service awarded Southern Oregon University nearly $100,000 to survey several more Rogue River Indian War sites and then seek a National Register of Historic Places nomination. Tveskov hopes this eventually raises the profile of the battlefields and leads to better conservation and interpretation. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi near Gold Beach, Oregon.
According to the Commerce Department, more homes were under construction last month than at any point in the last 8 years. Groundbreaking on new homes also rose to a five-month high. But the Consumer Price Index, how much we pay for various goods, was flat last month. Joining us now is CNBC's Bertha Coombs. She's at the New York Mercantile Exchange. And Bertha, tell us about the housing starts first, the new home construction. What's happening?
It's a very good sign to see that we are seeing more groundbreaking on new homes. We had seen very weak residential construction investment, and that had been one of the things that had worried people. A lot of younger folks just aren't in a position to buy a new home, so you're seeing a lot of the builders on the lower end aren't building. A lot of the building that we're seeing and the growth is on the higher end. Boomers and folks who have already gotten into home once and are trading up are more likely to go out and try to pursue a mortgage, which I can tell you from personal experience these days is a really long process. So that's one of the things that makes it hard in housing for people to trade up, qualifying for a mortgage, and then even though they qualify, they have to jump through an awful lot of hoops in order to get one.
Then there was some news today about the Consumer Price Index, which was flat. This is a change from recent months. What's going on there?
It's a mixed bag. A lot of the folks who sell us stuff are having trouble raising prices. They're having trouble making more money. So we don't want to get into a situation where we have deflation. If people keep thinking that, hey, you know what, I'm going to wait and not buy something because it's going to be cheaper, that's not very good for the economy. It also puts the Federal Reserve in a tough spot. They would like to raise interest rates in order to be able to have a bit of a cushion for when the economy goes into recession, to lower them again and spur investment. But right now, with inflation low and a lot of sort of sluggishness some people feel in the economy, that leaves them in a precarious position when you think about if we fall into inflation, they're kind of going to be out of ammunition in terms of what they can do, perhaps, to try to help stimulate the economy.
One more thing I have to ask you about, Bertha. You apparently are calling this rally in the stock market that we've been having the Rodney Dangerfield rally. Explain.
Yeah. You know, for those of us who are old enough to remember the comedian Rodney Dangerfield, his classic line was, "I don't get any respect." There are a lot of folks who really don't feel like this is based on real fundamentals because we've seen S&P 500 earnings continuing to be lower year over year. You're not seeing a big jump when it comes to productivity. But there's also the phrase that people use called TINA, which stands for there is no alternative. If you are looking for some sort of growth in your investments, you kind of have to be in stocks because that's the only thing that's growing. Bonds are returning so little. And if you're looking at foreign bonds around the world, in some cases, they have negative rates. People are actually paying to have a little security in bonds. So they're very interesting times, and a lot of people are just wondering how long we can go on this way.
CNBC's Bertha Coombs joining us from the New York Mercantile Exchange. Bertha, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Election day is now less than 3 months away, and the presidential candidates and their surrogates are hitting the trail hard. Yesterday, the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, and Vice President Joe Biden were at a rally in Scranton, Pennsylvania. On the Republican side, Donald Trump was in Youngstown, Ohio, along with his running mate, Governor Mike Pence, for a more formal Trump speech on security.
Much of what we hear in this election comes in quick soundbites, so we wanted to take a few minutes right now to offer up some longer sections of some of these speeches, starting with Mike Pence speaking yesterday.
I was in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill on September 11, 2001. I walked along with Mayor Giuliani in the ashes and rubble of Ground Zero just about a week later in New York City. And with my family at my side, I have stood in a quiet field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the heroes and the victims of Flight 93 met their fate. Since then, I've seen the sacrifices of the American soldier in the global war on terror. And then I watched, over the last 7.5 years, as the hard-fought gains that they won were squandered by the failed foreign policy of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. History teaches that weakness arouses evil, and the weak leadership of President Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, leading from behind, moving red lines, making so-called deals and ransom payments to the radical mullahs in Iran, the rise, rule, and reign of ISIS are a testament to this truth of history. Donald Trump knows that America needs to be strong for the American people and the world to be safe.
Well, Trump followed with a speech outlining his plan for extreme vetting of immigrants coming to the U.S., and he addressed what he said were the mistakes of the Iraq War and his plan to fight ISIS.
In the old days, when we won a war, to the victor belonged the spoils. Instead, all we got from Iraq and our adventures in the Middle East was death, destruction, and tremendous financial loss. But it's time to put the mistakes of the past behind us and chart a new course. If I become president, the era of nation building will be brought to a very swift and decisive end. Thank you. Our new approach, which must be shared by both parties in America, by our allies overseas, and by our friends in the Middle East, must be to halt the spread of radical Islam. All actions should be oriented around this goal, and any country which shares this goal will be our ally. Very important. Some don't share this goal. We cannot always choose our friends, but we can never fail to recognize our enemies. As president, I will call for an international conference focused on this goal. We will work side by side with our friends in the Middle East, including our greatest ally, Israel. We will partner with King Abdullah of Jordan and the president of Egypt, President Sisi, and all others who recognize this ideology of death that must be extinguished. We will also work very closely with NATO on this new mission. I had previously said that NATO was obsolete because it failed to deal adequately with terrorism. Since my comments, they have changed their policy and now have a new division focused on terror threats. Very good. Very, very good. I also believe that we could find common ground with Russia in the fight against ISIS. Wouldn't that be a good thing? Wouldn't that be a good thing?
Some sound from the Republican ticket yesterday, Trump, before that Pence. The Democrats were in rally mode. Here's Vice President Biden.
I have worked with 8 presidents of the United States. I have served with hundreds of senators, only 13 senators in history, I'm embarrassed to say, have served as long as I have. Dozens of secretaries of state and secretaries of defense of both parties. And I can say without hesitation, my word is a Biden, no major party nominee in the history of the United States of America has, now don't cheer or quiet, just listen, has known less or been less prepared to deal with our national security than Donald Trump. And what absolutely amazes me, that he doesn't seem to want to learn it. No, I really mean it. He doesn't seem to want to learn it. He doesn't seem to think it matters. This man is totally, thoroughly unqualified to be president of the United States of America.
And finally, here is Hillary Clinton.
No matter what Donald Trump says, America is great, and the American dream is big enough for everyone to share in its promise. But that doesn't mean we can take it for granted and just wait till it happens to us. We have a lot of work to do. Here in Scranton, you know that. President Obama and Vice President Biden pulled us back from the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression and put our economy back on a stronger footing. I personally don't think they get enough credit for that. Under their leadership, we've created 15 million new private sector jobs. 20 million people now have health care, and the auto industry just had its best year ever. So I think the job of the next president is to build on that, but to take on the deeper challenges that emerged long before the crisis and have persisted through our recovery. Inequality is too high. Wages are too low. It is still too hard for too many to get ahead. So my top priority is creating an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top, which is why I've set 5 ambitious goals to get us there. First, we're going to make the biggest investment in new good-paying jobs since World War II. Second, we're going to make college debt-free for all and help millions of people struggling with existing student debt. Third, we're going to crack down on companies that ship jobs and profits overseas. And we're going to reward companies that share profits with their employees like the Scranton Lace Company did almost a century ago. Fourth, you. Fourth, we're going to make sure that Wall Street corporations and the super rich finally pay their fair share of taxes. And fifth, we're going to respond to the way American families actually live and work today by making childcare affordable, because in today's economy, there is often no parent or grandparent staying home with the kids. And we're going to fight for paid family leave, because sometimes you need to take care of your child or your spouse or sick parent, and you should not lose your job for taking care of the loved one.
As we said, a chance to hear more than the usual sound bites. Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Mike Pence. And you know how the saying goes on the sitcoms, no soup for you? Well, today we have soup for you, do we not, Jeremy?
We have soup for us, actually, and it's right in front of us. And why? Because Kathy Gunst is here, our resident chef, right across the table. Kathy, great to see you as always. And tell us, why soup?
Well, several reasons. One is it turns out it's a very good summer food, though you don't think about it that way. There is an entire world of cold soups to explore, everything from Russian borscht with red beets to vichyssoise to Spanish gazpachos, cold cucumber soup. You can make cold soups from almost anything, and also hot soups like chowder is the classic summer soup in New England. So I thought we'd mix it up a bit.
And you've got a chowder right here in front of us.
I do indeed. You've got a beautiful hot chowder there made with clams, swordfish, haddock, potatoes from the garden, little bit of milk and cream. And
when you say a little bit,
yes,
this is what I always think about.
Okay.
I love clam chowder, but it does have a lot of cream.
It depends where you get it. What I do is I make a base with the juice from the clams and some fish stock. So I have this beautiful fish soup that you honestly could eat without dairy, but dairy is what defines so much chowder, and particularly New England chowder. So in a pot that I made that serves about 8, there is, I think, a half a cup. So in your bowl, Jeremy, maybe you got a tablespoon there. You still talking to me?
Yeah.
Well, it's creamy.
I'm actually eating it. So,
I know. Yeah. And we won't mention that half the bowl's gone before we even went on
And
air.
We've got the recipe. We've got the recipe, by the way, at hereandnow.org if you want to go and take a look at this delicious, what would you call this, a fish chowder?
A fish and clam chowder.
Fish and
clam. I love all kinds. You could shuck fresh corn into that.
I was just going to say, that's the great thing about chowder. You put all the leftovers in it.
It's so adaptable. Yeah. It's hugely adaptable. I love making corn chowder, but I also like corn and fish chowder. I was really surprised how well the swordfish worked in that chowder. Mm-hmm. Now, I know we don't want to be eating a lot of swordfish because of mercury levels, but wherever you are in the country, you want to use whatever fish is fresh.
And will hold.
And yeah, well, chowder doesn't last long because it's so delicious, but it's very adaptable, and there's many different types of fish, shellfish, seafood you can throw in.
Okay.
You mentioned one of my favorite words, vichyssoise.
Vichyssoise.
Yes.
So I'll tell you a quick funny story.
Anytime you can work it into the conversation.
Yeah. Well, he has his striped shirt on today and he's looking très français.
All right, there.
Now people will think I'm bilingual. I wanted to make vichyssoise. I was in a friend's house in France a few weeks ago, lucky me, and I had to borrow a blender from the man who owns the cafe down the street. So I made my vichyssoise and I was so excited, and I returned the blender and I said, I made some soup. I wanted to share it with you. He looked at this. He says, cold? I'm like, yeah, cold. He had never seen it. It turns out that vichyssoise is, even though it has the French word.
Well, remind people what it is.
Yes, I will. Yeah. It is leek and potato soup when it's hot. And when it's cold leek and potato soup, and it's called vichyssoise.
Huh.
It's extremely easy to make. You saute some leeks, just the white parts, because it's classically a white soup. And then you add some peeled potatoes, you add chicken stock or vegetable stock, and you let it simmer. And again, you add a touch of cream. What I did on top of the soup that makes it really look so beautiful, I think, is I made a chive oil, equal parts chive and olive oil. Throw it into the blender. It'll keep for a week. It's great
beautiful.
On salad. Isn't it just...
Yeah, you drizzled it on top.
I drizzled on... It almost looks like that Italian marbled paper. It's just beautiful.
Sometimes your recipes are too complicated for me, but this one...
You can do it,
I
right?
have to go and do this
yes.
because it's so delicious.
I think you can too. And just one last because...
What do you mean my recipes are too difficult?
No, no. He did
for me.
Mean,
for
yes,
me, Kathy.
The working man. I try to keep them simple.
Touch on one last one, because sometimes you don't want to turn on the stove. So give us a quick suggestion.
A wonderful, quick, throw it in the blender, no cooking, no heat, is a cucumber and buttermilk soup with fresh dill. You literally take a few ingredients and throw it in the blender. And, of course, gazpacho is no cooking. Lots of tomatoes and onions and peppers, and everything goes into a food processor or a blender. And then you add a bit of vinegar for that piquancy. And then I add lots of chopped raw vegetables on top. Summer soups are meant to be light and refreshing, but you can also think of them as a new version of a salad.
Yeah.
All that wonderful summer produce in a bowl. It's just, it's one of my favorite things to eat in summer because you can make it ahead of time and live off of it for a few days. And it is, I don't know, they're both very refreshing, I think.
And you've got a book coming out in September.
I do. Soup Swap.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, all about making soups and swapping soups and building community. And we'll be talking about it more. It comes out in a month. But the vichyssoise and the chowder are both in the book.
And they are also at hereandnow.org. Right. And we'll put them there right now.
Well, and you know, while we're talking about sharing and sharing knowledge, we just want to pay tribute to, I know, a chef that you and I know, Jeremy, you admired, Chef Michel Richard, who died just this past Saturday, just 68. Now, he was known for his Los Angeles restaurant Citrus. For Citronelle in D.C., you've been there, Jeremy.
Yeah, and Centrale in D.C., and this is being credited as a restaurant that really put D.C. on the map as a foodie destination. Of course, now
it's
it
hot.
Is filled with amazing
But he was
restaurant.
So creative, and he really transformed food into very interesting textures and colors and flavors.
I got to work with him on a show called Ready, Set, Cook, and people said to me, why would you ever want to host a show like that on the Food Channel? I said, because I got to work with Michel Richard,
who,
after imbibing some of the wine, he would do the show entirely in French. We're sorry at his passing. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson with Kathy Gunst. It's Here and Now.